First, let's review what is causal set theory in general, and then I will proceed to what I was doing in my problem. So basically, causal set theory is a model of space-time, which is one of the proposed ways of addressing the issue of quantum theory of gravity. As it is known, a lot of approaches to quantum theory of gravity involve discretization of space-time. And basically, the idea of discretizing the space-time is to say that the manifold structure breaks down on a smaller scale, and that will help us to avoid various problems that are associated with quantum gravity that would arise mainly on a small scale. And however, the problem with discretizing the space-time in general is that when you discretize it, you break Lorentzian invariance. For example, think of a lattice. In case of lattice, there are edges of a lattice and there are diagonals, and they are clearly not equivalent to each other. So we have different directions that are not equivalent to each other. For that reason, usually when people address quantum theory of gravity, they are not usually using lattice, but they're using some other discrete models where the violation of general relativistic invariance is not as obvious. But still, even though it's not as obvious, there will still be some kind of subtle variation of general relativistic invariance. The problem is typically will be solved by integration, because when you integrate over the causal sets, or not causal sets, but over different kinds of discrete structures, the relativistic invariance is usually being restored. And the idea of causal set theory is that it proposes a way to make it look better. The way the specific discrete model of space-time proposed in causal set theory is better, so to speak, is that relativistic invariance is very much there, even on a level of a single discrete structure. So you don't need to actually integrate to restore the invariance. In case of causal sets, it's there from the beginning. And the way in which it works is the following. We say that in case of causal sets, the only fundamental property of that kind of discrete space-time is the causal relations between points, and that's it. So we have no coordinates and nothing else that we are used to. We just have a discrete set of points together with the causal relations on them. This has been reinforced by an observation made by Hawking in the 70s, and the observation was this: that if we have any kind of Lorentzian manifold, we can completely recover its structure from the information about the measure together with causal relations. Now, in case where things are discrete, the measure is defined in a natural way by simply counting of points. So the only thing that is left for us to put in, the only extra information, is the causal relations, which is why in the discrete case, causal relations is the only fundamental thing. However, there is a hole in that argument. The hole in that argument is this, that even though I said that if we have a Lorentzian manifold, we can completely restore its structure based on the measure and the causal structure, we made one more assumption. And that other assumption is that we know that it's a manifold. In general, we don't have to know that it's a manifold. In fact, if we have a discrete set of points and try to simulate causal relations between them, what we often get is something that doesn't look like a manifold at all. For example, there was one kind of process which is called dynamical percolation. And that's when you keep creating new points, and whenever you create new points, you decide the causal relation between the new points and the older points. And for each of the older points, with probability p, the new point is going to be after the older ones. And with probability 1 minus p, it's going to be space-like to them, which means causal and related. What people found out is that in this case, we get a lot of so-called posts, where by post, we mean a point that is causally related to every single other point. In other words, it's a type of Big Bangs. And those points are only separated by maybe few points. So it's like a lot of Big Bangs that are only few plug scales apart, and that doesn't look very good. So one of the problems of quantum gravity is to somehow come up with, not quantum gravity, but causal sets, is to somehow to come up with the model of the growth of this kind of causal set in such a way that it looks more like a manifold. In other words, ideally, I would like causal set to look like something that we would obtain by sprinkling points on a manifold. If we sprinkle points on a manifold, we get some kind of causal relations. And I would like the causal relation that I produce to be something that you would likely get by sprinkling the points on a manifold. But at the same time, I clearly don't want any kind of outside manifold to sprinkle them on. So the challenge is to somehow you make some kind of intrinsic property of the causal relations, or postulate some kind of intrinsic property of causal relations in a way that it will look like a manifold. And in general, people who are working in causal sets think of this as follows. They would first would like to make sure that the causal set is manifold-like without worrying about introducing any kinds of fields on the causal set. And only after they answer this question, they are planning to introduce some kind of matter fields in that causal set. In other words, the philosophy is that you have to first create a stage, and then after you create a stage, you put actors on that stage. Even though from the outside this philosophy makes sense, personally, this is not the type of thing that I would choose to do. The reason for this is because when I was thinking about various ways of making causal sets manifold-like, I came up with more than one way of doing that. And each of those ways have its own philosophy that are not compatible with each other. The reason for this is because the very criteria of manifold-like is from the beginning subjective. Because strictly speaking, if it's a discrete set of points, it's not the same as a manifold, because manifold is continuum. So the question is, how can you make it look like a manifold? And what do we mean by look like in quotes? Look like is a subjective statement. And I personally don't like the idea of selecting one subjective model in favor of others, unless I have extremely good reason of answering why I selected that model. So personally, when I try to work on the issue of how to make causal set manifold-like, I'm trying to do it in many different ways at once. And those different ways are not compatible with each other. So I have many different versions of a causal set, so to speak. And then I will leave the door open for myself to select which version I prefer better for the future. And because that is something I would like to do, I clearly do not want to first create a stage and then put actors on that stage. The reason for this is because I'm trying to create more than one stage at once. So I would have to create each set of actors for each individual stage. And that is not something that I am personally in favor of doing. Personally, I would like to invent one set of actors and train them in such a way that they would be suited for all possible stages. And for that matter, I might as well train them in such a way that they will be also suited for the situation where there is no stage at all. In other words, I would like to define the bosonic field theory in such a way that it makes sense for any causal sets, even the ones that are clearly not manifold-like at all. So for example, if you have a causal set with a bunch of posts in it, which makes it definitely non-manifold-like, I would like my quantum field theory to be well defined in that kind of causal set as well. And then I will simply substitute that general quantum field theory into whatever specific causal set that I believe is manifold-like, whatever I decided to mean. Now, the basic challenge of doing this is as follows. In quantum field theory, as we all know, we always use some kind of Lorentzian indices. Whenever you use Lorentzian indices, you are talking about something that is no longer well defined outside of the context of the manifold. So the basic question is, how do I get around that problem? The good news is that I'm not the first person who done something like that. Think, for example, of the definition of trigonometric function in terms of Taylor series, which allows us to define trigonometric function of a tensor. So there one can ask a similar question. How can you define trigonometric function of a tensor if there is no such thing as a triangle whose angle is a tensor? And if people were able to answer that question, there is no reason to assume that I cannot answer similar question in my situation. In my situation, The problem is pretty much similar if you think about it. I propose to answer that question as follows. I will first come up with the problem in the manifold case. And I will design my problem in such a way that its answer would not have an explicit reference to Lorentzian indices. And then I will use the answer to this problem as a definition of the Lagrangian. So the problem that I would like to come up with is as follows. So I have a Lorentzian manifold, which is what we are used to think of as a manifold. And on that manifold, I'm going to select a bounded region. Then I'm going to distribute finitely many points on that bounded region according to Poisson process. Since they are on a manifold, clearly they do have coordinates. However, the coordinates are treated as unknowns. For example, I don't have rulers to measure the spatial coordinates, and I don't have watches to measure time coordinates. However, there are a number of things that are viewed as knowns. For example, I can measure the causal structure between them. For example, I can try to send signals from one of those points to other points and see from which point a signal can get to which other point. Apart from that, I can also measure the value of scalar field at each of those points. But I cannot measure the value of scalar field at any other location of that continuum space-time. However, despite the fact that I can measure the value of scalar field at those points, I can neither measure the value of gauge field at those points, nor can I measure the value of gravitational field at those points. The agenda of my posing a problem in that way is because, unlike scalar field, both gauge field and gravitational field have Lorentzian indices. And whatever has Lorentzian indices, I will define to be unknown in the statement of that problem. And that will assure that the answer to this problem will not have any explicit dependence on the Lorentzian indices. However, I have some ways of inferring the information about both gravitational field as well as the information about the gauge field. As far as gravitational field goes, I have a way of inferring its behavior by looking at the causal structure between those points. Since the causal structure, by which we mean whether or not you can get from one point to the other without going faster than the speed of light, clearly does depend on the metric, which is gravitational field. As far as gauge field goes, I have some way of measuring the phase shift associated with gauge field along each of the geodesic segments that connect any pair of those points. For example, if those two points are causally related, then most likely I could draw some time-like geodesic segment that connects them. Then I can take a beam of electrons and somehow localize them to make sure that they are all flying along that geodesic segment without spreading out. How to do it is not relevant to the problem. And if I localize those electrons to move along that time-like geodesic segment, then on the receiving end of that geodesic segment, on the future end of that segment, I can look at and count how many of those electrons became neutrinos. And that would be a way of measuring phase shift associated with the weak field. In case where the geodesic segment is space-like, I would have to send them faster than the speed of light, which is not possible. But for the purposes of the problem, we can just assume that somehow we also know a way of measuring the phase shift along the space-like geodesic segment as well. And now, based on the information that I just given you, I would like to make an estimate of the scalar field Lagrangian density at each of those points, also gauge field Lagrangian density at each of those points, and also gravitational field Lagrangian density at each of those points. And obviously, the assumption will be that the fields are slowly varying. And that answer will be independent of the Lorentzian indices. And that is assured by the fact that anything that was known did not have any Lorentzian indices in it. And then, after I obtain my answer, I will turn things around. And the basic thing that I will do when I turn things around is that I will say that this is no longer a solution to a problem, but rather it's a definition. This is similar to the Taylor series case, where at first Taylor series was a solution to a problem as to how can you compute trigonometric functions without having rulers to measure the sides of the triangle. But then it turned into the definition of the trigonometric function for a general case. So in particular, what I will do is like this. Anything that was treated in this problem as unknown, which would include the coordinates of those points, as well as gauge field at those points and gravitational field at those points, from now on will be treated as non-existent and poorly defined. On the other hand, anything that was treated as known, from now on will be viewed as fundamental. For example, up until now, causal relations was not fundamental. It was a consequence of particular behavior of a metric. But from now on, metric no longer exists and causal relations become fundamental. Also, up until now, the phase shift associated with gauge field was not fundamental. The fundamental was gauge field itself, while the phase shift was just an exponent of the integration of the gauge field. But from now on, this will become fundamental. Gauge field no longer exists, but phase shift will be fundamental, and that would be defined as SUN-valued function associated with the set of pairs of points in the causal set. And finally, the Lagrangian that I got used to be just the solution to the problem, and it was only an approximation to the Lagrangian density that works in a special case where the function is smoothly is differentiable and slowly varying. But from now on, this will no longer be an approximation of a Lagrangian, but this will be a definition of a Lagrangian. On the other hand, the Lagrangian that we know from standard quantum field theory will no longer be Lagrangian. And from now on, that Lagrangian will be an approximation to Lagrangian I have here. So what I will claim is that the Lagrangian that I'm going to obtain is going to be the Lagrangian, while the standard quantum field theory Lagrangian will only be an approximation to the Lagrangian that I'm going to obtain when I solve this problem. Now, this can raise some basic questions. The first question is the following. When I'm going to be solving this problem, I'm going to assume that things are manifold-like. But I would like the Lagrangian to be well-defined for all causal sets, not just the manifold. So the answer to this question is that since we have no way of experimentally observing what happens when we are not on the manifold, I can simply claim that by some divine inspiration, I know that this is the Lagrangian for all cases. And in the special case of the manifold, it just happens to coincide with the standard Lagrangian. The second question one might get is this. When I was solving that problem, I was assuming specific dimensionality of the manifold, say dimensionality D. And in fact, my answer to the problem is going to depend on the value of D. So, but the question is this. I would like that answer to be a definition of Lagrangians for all causal sets. So in particular, I can define a causal set to be sprinkling of points on a manifold with dimensionality D prime, where D prime is different from D. So how come I will still use D if the manifold will have a dimensionality D prime? The answer to this question is that yes, I will still be using D even in case where D prime is not the same as D. And the reason I'm saying this is because D is no longer going to be a dimensionality, but rather the D would just be one of the constants that would figure into Lagrangian. And it would be mere coincidence that that constant happened to be an integer. And the other coincidence would be that in the special case where dimensionality happens to be that particular constant D, even though that particular constant D has nothing to do with the dimensionality, in that special case, my Lagrangian will be able to be approximated by the standard quantum field theory Lagrangian. In all the other dimensionalities, quantum field theory Lagrangian will no longer be a good approximation. Even though standard quantum field theory Lagrangian is clearly well defined for any kind of dimensionality, as long as dimensionality is something, it will no longer be a good approximation to the Lagrangian, while my Lagrangian will always be the right one. And we simply were lucky to live in the dimensionality D, where it happened to be a good approximation. And the final question is, what about the fact that I was assuming that the fields are slowly varying when I was solving that problem? Because if they're fast varying, then again, this is not going to be a good approximation. The answer to this question is this. I'm not the first one who makes similar assumption. Think, for example, of lattice field theory. In case of lattice field theory, they replace the derivative with the difference between the values of the function in the neighboring lattice point. Despite the fact that they did that, which implies the assumptions that the function varying slowly, despite that, they were integrating of all possible functions, including fast varying ones. What rescued them is the fact that in case of fast varying functions, they get a lot of interference. And due to the interference, the contributions of fast varying function canceled off each other. So what I hope is that in my case, the same thing will happen. But they didn't simply hope that. What they did is that they sat down and did the calculations of the propagator based on the discrete space-time. And they got the answer that they expected. In my case, I would have to do similar calculations, which in my case would be numerical simulations on the computer. And that is something I have not done yet. So technically, I'm yet to compute the actual propagator and actually verify that if I take random sprinkling on a manifold and compute the propagator based on my methods, I would get what I expect. However, I have a good reason to expect that I will get the answer affirmative, and that's because that's what they got in the lattice case. Now let us move to actually solving those problems for those fields all the time that I was talking about that problem. So let's start from the scalar field. So before I'm going to solve this problem for any kind of slowly varying scalar field, I will make simplifications. The two simplifications will be that the space-time is actually flat and the scalar field is linear. And then after I have done solving it for that special case, I will then go ahead and generalize it for a general case where things are not necessarily flat or linear. So basically what I will do is as follows. First of all, I'm going to, first of all, I'm going to realize that I need more than one point in order to get an approximation of derivative of the function. So the way I get more than one point is by selecting Alexandrov set. So if here is a point P in the random sprinkling of points, I will select some point Q. And the point Q will be after point P. And then I will look at the set bounded by two light cones. One light cone coming from the point P to the future, and the other light cone coming from the point Q in the past. And I'm going to explore the behavior of the field in that region. Now, since I assume that space-time is flat, and since I also assume that the field is linear, I have no fear about selecting this Alexandrov set to be too large, because I don't have to worry about any quadratic effects. However, I do have a fear of selecting it too small. And that's because if it's too small, then the random fluctuations that are due to the small number of points will basically distort the result. So I make a restriction. And the restriction is that the number of elements of that Alexandrov set is going to be greater than M. And I will introduce some notation. Alexandrov set based on P and Q would be this region. So this would be a set of points R, where P is before R and R is before Q. And that sign simply means before. The reason it means before is because just like if A is less than B and B is less than C, then A is less than C. In the same way, if A is before B and B is before C, then A is before C. And for that reason, this is viewed as a partial ordering in the causal set context. And so my restriction is going to be that the number of elements of that Alexandrov set based on P and Q is going to be greater than M, where M is some large number. Also, since I'm assuming I'm on a manifold, I can select a coordinate system. Even though I have no ways of measuring coordinates, nothing can stop me from simply deciding where a coordinate axis should lie. So I'm going to say the t-axis passes through point P and Q, and the origin lies in the middle. Here is the origin. And in this coordinate system, since phi is linear, I will say that phi is equal to A mu x mu plus B. And if that is what I will say, then the Lagrangian associated with phi will look like this. The Lagrangian L of phi is going to be equal to 1/2 A mu plus M square over 2 times phi square. This term I don't have to worry about because I was given that I know the value of phi at every point. So I know the value of this mass term. And what I have to find is basically this. Now, first let's start from finding A naught. A naught is going to be equal to phi of Q minus phi of P divided by the Lorentzian distance between P and Q. And now the Lorentzian distance, the way to evaluate Lorentzian distance between P and Q is by realizing that basically the volume of Alexandrov set based on P and Q is going to be basically equal to some constant, which depends on dimensionality, times the Lorentzian distance of P and Q taken to the power of D, where D is the dimensionality. But at the same time, we know that this volume of that region, we also know that this volume of that region based on P and Q can be approximated as basically rho, where rho is the density of our sprinkling, times the number of elements of that Alexandrov set based on P and Q. And from the fact that this is equal to this, we can infer the information about this by taking the ratio to the power of 1 over d. So now the answer that we get is going to be as follows. A naught is going to be equal to this difference between the values of phi divided by the distance. And the distance will be the volume taken to the power of 1 over d. And the volume is the number of elements of that the number of points that fall inside of that Alexandrov set divided by the density of points rho, and then there is some constant A where A depends on the dimensionality, and this whole thing is taken to the power of 1 over D. But A naught is not all that we need. We also need the information about other elements of other A, because we would like to find A mu. So the way we get the information about other A is by looking at this kind of sum. We're going to take the points R and S. The points R and S that fall inside of that Alexandrov set based on P and Q. And we are going, and for each of those points, we're going to the sum of phi of R minus phi of S square. If we are going to multiply it by 1 over rho square, which is the square of the volume element, the sum will be approximately equal to the integral. And then this integral will be equal to one coefficient times A naught square plus the other coefficient times the sum of AK squared. And the reason there is the same coefficient next to the square of which AK is the cylindrical symmetry that results from the specific choice of coordinates. But now this is not what I want. I would like a naught square minus this, and I don't like the fact that b is not equal to c. But I have a way of dealing with this. After all, I just computed a naught independently. So all I have to do is square this expression and subtract this expression from the square of this expression from this with appropriate coefficient. Or rather, multiply square of this expression by appropriate coefficient, and from that expression subtract that expression. So what we get is that if we choose coefficient in this way, then we will see that a mu a mu is equal to basically this. And now, even though this looks rather complicated, actually this is not. This whole complicated things come from the dimensional analysis. Basically, the way I got this weird power is like this. As you see in this integral, there is the dimensionality here is distance to the power 2d plus 2. Now, since the dimensionality of volume is distance to the power of d, then distance to the power of 2d plus 2 is the same as volume to the power of 2 plus 2 over d. So that's why we have volume to the power of 2 plus 2 over d. And volume is the number of elements that fall into here divided by density. So that's why this sum is equal to this. And because of this, we can move this whole thing on the other side, and we get that this is equal to this. And the reason this is 2 over d as opposed to 2 plus 2 over d is because of the constellation with 1 over rho squared over here. And this 1 over rho squared comes from the square of the volume element. And then if we take this and take the linear combination of this with the square of this, we get this expression. And as you see, this doesn't depend on the dimensionality. Not dimensionality, but it doesn't have any Lorentzian indices. But now there is a catch here. As you remember, I was assuming that the field phi is linear. But that's not the assumption I would want to make. Eventually, I would like to assume that that phi is the differentiable function that varies reasonably slowly. Also, I was assuming that the space-time is flat. Again, that is not the assumption I would like to make. I would like to say that the space-time is curved by the curve which is differentiable and slowly varying. So I would address this issue in the following way. I would like to go from the linear case to the general case. And this transparency is not specific about scalar field phi, because this would be the same thing that would apply to any other field that I'm going to use. Basically, the idea is the following. I would have to somehow select an Alexandrov set, where by Alexandrov set I mean the space bounded by two light cones, in such a way that inside of that Alexandrov set, space-time is approximately flat and fields are approximately linear. That's what I have to do. The naive way of doing it is to take the idea from calculus, that you can make things linear by making all the distances very small. So based on calculus, I would want the two endpoints of Alexandrov set to be extremely close to each other. And if they are close, then everything here will be flat and linear. And from what I told you before, I even have a way of finding out whether or not they are close. All I have to do is to look at the volume of this Alexandrov set by counting points in a sprinkling that fall inside of it. And then they say the distance is equal to volume to the power of 1 over d. However, even though naively that is true, it's actually a very bad way of doing it. The reason it is very bad is that Lorentzian distance can be arbitrarily small in the vicinity of light cone. However, we know that in the vicinity of light cone, the scalar field would not be linear. So this is not how I'm going to do it for the reasons I just told you. Instead, what I would do is the following. I would take a large Alexandrov set, and inside of that large Alexandrov set, I'm going to look at the Lagrangian densities at different small regions on that Alexandrov set. And I'm going to compare them. And then I will see, do they really approximate each other? In other words, is the largest possible Lagrangian density at those locations approximately equal to the smallest possible Lagrangian density at those locations? If the answer is yes, then field is approximately linear there. But now the question is, how do I approximate those Lagrangian densities? From what I told you before, I don't know how to do it at a point. I only know how to do it at the Alexandrov set. So this means that what I will do is I will draw some small Alexandrov sets at different locations and approximate the Lagrangian densities at those different Alexandrov sets. So here I have L1, here I have L2, here I have L3, etc. And then I'm going to look at maximal L1 minus minimal of all of them, L1. But now the question is this. How can I even approximate Lagrangian density in those Alexandrov sets? After all, from what I have shown, I only know how to do it if I know that things are linear. But here I don't know that things are linear. If I knew that things are linear, I wouldn't have to find out. If I'm trying to find out whether the field is linear, I cannot assume that it is linear. The answer to this question is this. You suppose it is not linear. If it is not linear, then those complicated expressions that I got for estimating Lagrangian density for the linear field will just be a bunch of random numbers. And if I have a bunch of random numbers, there is no reason for that bunch of random numbers to be approximately equal to here, 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 etc. So if we have a million of small causal sets over here, and for each of them get some random number, and in all million cases, they happen to be approximately equal to each other, then one would wonder that something must be going on. And the only thing that must be going on is that field is probably approximately linear on that whole region, because that would be the only explanation for such an unlikely coincidence. Now I need to have some kind of criteria of smallness, like how small should this difference be? My criteria of smallness is going to be, and also I forgot to mention that I also have to set up a low bound on the number of points. At each of those small Alexandrov sets, from what I told before, there has to be more than m points in order to avoid random fluctuations, because if there would be some Alexandrov sets that only have two or three points, then random fluctuations will make that expression act crazy. And then even if the function is linear, it will never pass the test for linearity. So each of those small Alexandrov sets should have more than m points. Furthermore, I have to make sure that inside of this big Alexandrov set, more than just a handful of those small Alexandrov sets can fit in. If the big Alexandrov set contains only two or three small Alexandrov sets, then there would be nothing amazing about the Lagrangians being approximately equal in each of them. After all, one might as well have two or three coincidences. So that big Alexandrov set should have more than n points, and n is a lot greater than m. And now one would associate the error of that big Alexandrov set, which I denote by alpha p comma q, where p is this point and q is this point, to be basically equal to maximal L1, L2, etc., minus minimal L1, L2, etc. And now I have to find a way of somehow finding that big Alexandrov set whose error is going to be small. For the future purposes, I'm going to do it in use the following trick to do that. Since I assume that the field is slowly varying, I know that there is at least one Alexandrov set whose error is small. If I know that there is at least one Alexandrov set whose error is small, then I will know that if I take the Alexandrov set whose error is smallest possible, then that smallest possible error will automatically be small. So I'm going to select a point Q of basically P, comma, phi. And Q of P comma phi is going to be defined in such a way that error of Alexandrov set based on P and Q of P comma phi is always going to be less than or equal to error of Alexandrov set based on P and R, whenever R is greater than P. And the assumption being is that both this Alexandrov set has more than n elements, and also this Alexandrov set has more than n elements, because those are the only Alexandrov sets we are talking about. Anything else would just cause problems. And then after I done that, I will say that the Lagrangian of the field phi at the point P is going to be basically be approximately equal to Lagrangian of field phi based on the Alexandrov set of P comma that point alpha of P comma phi. But now I notice an interesting feature. Even though this approximation is only true for the slowly varying fields, it formally makes sense for the fast varying fields as well. In case where we have fast varying fields, the error is always going to be huge, no matter what. However, if all the errors are huge, we can still find out the smallest possible error. For example, all errors will be larger than a million, and the smallest possible error will be a million. So we will select an Alexandrov set whose error is a million. And then what we're going to do is we're going to simply formally define, and that part is going to be formal. I'm going to say that now this is not an approximation to the Lagrangian, but this is an exact definition of the Lagrangian. And this exact definition will, by definition, be true even for the fast varying fields. And then, as I said before, I'm quoting that in case of fast varying fields, interference terms will ensure that their contribution will cancel each other out anyways. So even if my assertion is wrong, nobody will ever catch me wrong. And that is based on the example of what people done in the lattice case, where the contributions of fast varying fields canceled each other out. Now, since I'm running out of time, I'm going to only show the result for the case of the gauge field. So in principle, gauge field can. So I'm just going to show the results for the gauge field. You basically, in case of gauge field, what I will have to do is I'm going to say that I have some function u, and u corresponds to the phase shift. So u is the function whose argument is the pairs of point elements of S, and whose value is SUN. So that's the definition of U. And in case of the manifold, basically U is equal to the exponent of the integral of TA, A mu, DX mu, along the geodesic. And now, if you have 3 points, then u of a comma b, u of b comma c, and u of c comma a, will be this Wilson's loop. And clearly, in case of the lack of the scalar fields, this product is going to be equal to one. So the effect of the gauge fields is this minus one. So this product minus one would be the effect of the gauge field. And while this calculation will take a little bit of time, I can just give you the result that if we are going to look at that this quantity, which would be the sum of the Wilson's loops that go like that, where those two are the endpoints of the Alexandrov set, and the point here is some other point. This would give us the sum of F0k square. And on the other hand, the sum of the Wilson's loop that go like that, so here is some other Wilson loop. This one will going to give us the sum of Fij square plus the sum of F 0k square. And the coefficients are going to be, they're different. So there is going to be the coefficient k1, and then there is going to be the coefficient k2. And then by taking appropriate linear combination between this and this, which is similar for what was done in the scalar field, we will get the Lagrangian density of the gauge field.
In the case of the scalar field, at each element of the causal set, it just had a value. Are you assuming that for every pair of elements, you have an element of SUN, or only for certain pairs, or?
I'm assuming that for every pair of elements, I have an element of SUN. So if you give me any pair of elements, whether they be space-like or time-like related, I can return to you SUN. And if such is the case, then that would be the definition of the Lagrangian.
So your definition of the gauge field is a mapping of pairs of elements into SUN?
Yes.
But there'll be a worry about, maybe you'll come to this, but in the continuum, you mean that to correspond to an integral along some path, but which path?
The path would be the geodesic that connects the pairs of elements.
But globally, that's not unique, may not even exist if they're far apart.
So that is a good question, and I'm considering the case where it does exist, and the reason that's what I'm considering is because I don't want to take that seriously, because when I move to causal set, there is no such thing as a geodesic, because causal set is not embedded in the manifold. So because there is no such thing as a geodesic, that's why for causal set I can simply postulate that there is some mapping to SUN. However, if I were to simply say something like that, then this would look random. So before I have to make that random assertion for causal sets, I would like to take some simple example of a manifold like case that would somehow resemble that example. So here, so for the manifold like case, for the manifold like example that I'm using to motivate what I will do for causal sets, I'm assuming that any pair of points is connected by unique geodesic, which can be done by taking a small region on the manifold or something like that, or making things well behaved. So after I made that assertion for a manifold and I get my expression, then I will take that expression and use it as a definition for causal sets. And since that expression is well defined, if one assumes that there is that SUN valid function, and also since in case of causal sets you can simply postulate that SUN valid function because there is no such thing as a geodesic, then that expression formally makes sense.
Yeah, we can certainly postulate, but it seems that by having a lot of these distant points, pairs of points, it'll complicate the understanding of the continuum limit, or whether you would get back something that really does approximate a gauge field. I mean, when you do your integral over the all possible, your path integral over all possible gauge fields, there's a lot more things that have to cancel out miraculously now. I mean, that's my only worry.
Yeah. So I guess the way to address what you're saying is like that. In case of scalar fields, I said that I'm selecting the most flat region, the most flat Alexander set, and that would be the same thing that I would do for a gauge field and for gravity. The procedure is going to be identical. So if I'm selecting the most flat region for the gauge field, then in that most flat region, things would behave nicely. But that would be the assertion that the gauge field is basically smooth. So in your situation, you didn't assume that the gauge field was not smooth. You assumed that there is some global topology going on. So in the assumption that the gauge field is smooth, but there are some global topological effects, it is still possible to select the small Alexander set around points in which those global topological effects don't count.
Mm-hmm. I agree. My only point was that in the scalar field, there's the question of local smoothness versus roughness, whereas in this case, there's also a question of whether the long range matrices, SUN matrices, will somehow be compatible with the short range ones. There's an extra level of way in which this can deviate from being a slowly varying well-defined gauge field. That's all.
What I believe will happen is that even though I will formally say that the long range SUN will be something, that something which is long range SUN will not affect the result. The reason it will not affect the result is because when I get to the point of selecting small annulments under set like this, then the only SUN that will count is the SUN between the two pairs of elements between the Alexander set. But I imagine that the long-range point would be here. So even though formally there will be SUN between here and here, that SUN between here and here formally would not factor into whatever I'm doing inside of this Alexander set.
Okay.
Yes, so basically the reason I say that the SUN is between any pairs of points is because if I were to say that it is only between some pairs of points, I run a risk of not making it rigorous. So what I would like to do is to come up with a lot of extra information for SUN by defining it between all kinds of points that are far away from each other. But then I will make sure that that would be extra information. So I would have to make sure that this doesn't affect the Lagrangian. And the way I make sure that it doesn't affect the Lagrangian is because when I will come to the point of selecting Alexandrov set, I would not be selecting Alexandrov set that includes those two points far away. And the reason that Alexandrov set would not be selected is that the Alexandrov set would not pass the criteria for linearity.
Yeah, I'm happy.
Okay. So now let's move to the issue of the gravitational field. So, in case of gravitational field, what I would like to explore is something like this. I would be looking at an Alexandrov set that goes like this, and I will see the following. So here is a point P, and here is a point Q. And now the volume of the Alexandrov set based on P and Q divided by some constant that has to do with dimensionality d times the distance between P and Q taken to the power of d minus 1. In the flat case, this is going to be 0 in the flat case. But in the case of the curvature, it's no longer will be zero, but it will be equal to some kind of correction that is associated with Alexandrov set based on points P and Q. And I will use that correction in order to measure the gravitational field. I will use, and let me put down the. The transparency. Now again, I will set a t-axis that goes through P and Q. And if t-axis goes through P and Q, then the correction associated with points P and Q is going to be equal to proportional to d square multiplied by some linear combination. And that linear combination is going to be basically E times R 0 0 plus F R for some constants E and F. The reason I know that would be the case is by cylindrical symmetry. That's how I know none of the other elements of R will be there. And then there was a paper written by Gibbons and Saladuhin where they actually computed what E and F is equal to. But now I won't be able to actually compare the length, the distance to the volume if I'm going to use the measure of the distance that I used for scalar field, because in scalar field I use the volume to compute the distance. So if I do that, then that would be circular. So I need some kind of independent way of measuring the distance without using the volumes. And that independent way of measuring the distance is actually a very widely used in the causal set theory. So that part is going to be just a little bit of a review. Just a review of how people in general measure distance in causal set theory. Basically, even though you don't have to assume that things are locally flat, I'm going to do that anyway in order to make things simpler. So imagine that here is a locally flat region, and here is point P and point Q. And this is a manifold. And we are going to set T-axis that passes through P and Q. And also suppose that there is some curve gamma that connects P and Q. Then the length of gamma is going to be integral to of square root of dx naught square minus the sum of dxi square. Now, clearly, this is going to be less than or equal to what we get if we are going to throw this term away. So this is going to be less than or equal integral of absolute value of dx naught, which would be the square root of dx naught square. If gamma is future directed, then this is going to be equal to the integral of dx naught. And in this coordinate system, that would clearly be equal to the Lorentzian distance between P and Q. Now one might have a question, what if the curve goes like that? Then clearly its length is going to be greater than that Lorentzian distance. The answer to this question is that this curve is not a future directed. So when we made this step from here to here, we were assuming that it's a future directed. So the distance between P and Q is the length of the longest future directed curve that connects them. Now in the discrete case, we cannot actually single out the longest future directed curve. So what we instead have to do is to look at the future directed sequence of points. So we are going to look at the sequence of points P before R1, R1 is before R2, R2 is before et cetera, and then Rn is before Q. And then we are going to look at the maximum value of N for which such a sequence exists. Now one might have a question, a sequence of points doesn't need to be a curve-like sequence of points. How do I know it's curve-like? The way I know it is this. Suppose there is some point S, such as R1 is less than S, and S is less than R2. Then by inserting S into here, I will get longer sequence of points. So that would not be a longer sequence of points. So the fact that it is longer sequence of points means that we didn't skip over anything. So this means that those points are reasonably dense, so this is curve-like. And since it's curve-like sequence of points, then the fact that it is the longest possible implies that it approximates longest possible curve. And the number of points will be proportional to the actual length of that curve. And there was actual numerical methods done that actually showed that such is indeed the case. And now that I have an independent way of evaluating the distances and volumes, I go right back to here. By looking, I can then divide this by this times to the power of d, where this I can get by count the total number of points in Alexandrov set, and that would be the length of the longest sequence. But this is not what I want, because I would like to somehow isolate r, and here r not not plus something else times r. So the way to isolate r is by doing something like that. I'm going to look at some other Alexandrov sets that align inside of here. And I'm going to look at the corrections inside of those Alexandrov sets, and then I'm going to integrate over them. So those corrections associated with those Alexandrov sets would be the rotated version of this. And then if I'm going to integrate over them, I'm going to again get something of this form, because I will still have a cylindrical symmetry, but my coefficients are going to be different. Instead of E and F, my new coefficients would be G and H. And then by taking linear combination, I can isolate R. And again, as you see, R doesn't have explicit mention of coordinates. And then, of course, both in case of gauge field and in case of gravitational field, I was assuming approximate linearity. But the way I am going from approximate linearity to the general case, and then from general smooth case to arbitrary fluctuation case would be the same thing that I've done for scalar fields. So I am going to skip it just to save time. And now I am going to talk about some conclusion remarks. So as a conclusion, what I have shown is that I have shown a way to basically define the Lagrangian on without any reference to coordinates in a manifestly relativistic way. But then there are obviously going to be some problems associated with this. And I'm going to quickly illustrate the problems and then quickly outline my some of the thoughts that I have about addressing those problems. The first problem is quite obvious, that I was clearly cheating when I was adjusting coefficients in such a way as to maintain the relativistic invariance. If I'm saying that those Lagrangians do not come from the manifold and they are actually fundamental Lagrangians and it's a mere coincidence that in manifold case things happen to be that way, then the question is, how come those fundamental Lagrangians have such a weird coefficients in them? So what I'm thinking of doing is inventing some kind of natural selection process. So what I would, one thing I'm hypothesizing is that there are a lot more Lagrangians than just the ones that I wrote there. And in most cases, the Lagrangians are not going to end up being relativistically invariant. But what will happen in the Lagrangians that are not going to approximate anything relativistically invariant is this. Suppose the coefficients were not the ones that I thought, but suppose the coefficients were something else. Take, for example, a scalar field. And in scalar field, let's just assume that it is phi of q minus phi of p, and that's it. And just that. In this case, if we're going to take Alexandrov set that goes like this, we're going to get a very different answer from the answer that, if we're going to look at the small Alexandrov sets inside of that, then for this small Alexandrov set, we will get a very different answer from the Alexandrov set that is somewhat rotated. And so when we go to the stage of comparing the approximations of Lagrangians within the small Alexandrov sets, due to the fact that small Alexandrov sets can rotate with respect to each other, if the expression is not invariant with respect to the rotation, and also if we assume that we are in a special case of a manifold, then the error, so to speak, by which we mean the biggest Lagrangian minus the smallest, will always be very huge. And because of this, we will always have a large interference. And so I would expect the propagator to be very close to zero, because this situation will be similar to the situation where every single field is fast varying and there is no such thing as a slowly varying field. But since, and so what we can do is the following. We can say that the actual physical state is two different things. It's a selection of the Lagrangians out of all the Lagrangians that I propose, together with the actual propagators, together with the actual behavior of fields. And so if I made the wrong selection of the Lagrangians, then the probability associated with this will be very close to zero, no matter how fields act. And that is what would force me to make a right selection of Lagrangians. And if I have enough Lagrangians, the natural selection will force me to do what I have to do. The other question that I need to address is this. I'm going to view the causal relations as the variables. So I'm going to associate separate degree of freedom with any point in the causal set. And then I'm going to integrate over all possible partial orderings. And I'm going to view causal relations as just a partial ordering between those points. So this brings back to the question, if I'm integrating over all possible partial orderings, then quite independently from the criteria of them being manifold-like, how do I know that there is any kind of outside structure at all? The answer to this question is, again, hypothetical. I haven't worked that out yet. I just have some thoughts of how to do it. One thought is that I can view causal set as a viable. And by viewing puzzle set as a bable, I will actually be able to say that puzzle sets is fixed. And there is a fixed growth of puzzle sets, which is being viewed as a bable. And that is something I would have to work out. The other hypothesis that I have is maybe that I can use the idea of tunneling. So I'm not integrating over all possible Lagrangians, but I have some kind of tunnel, and I'm only integrating over the Lagrangians that fit inside the tunnel. So I'm integrating over tunnel of e to the il, where l depends on the phi, and phi fits within the tunnel. And by making the tunnel narrow enough, I will make sure that the causal sets have some kind of outside structure. And finally, the other thing is the old question that I started with as to how do I know that the causal sets are manifold, like, and how do I enforce them? And like I said before, I have different ways of doing that. One of the ways in which I'm thinking of doing it is by axiomatization. Like approximately a year ago, I read a book, Geometry of Time and Space by Rob, where he described flat Minkowski space in terms of the set of axioms, which is similar to the axioms for the Euclidean space. And so what I've done is that I found a way of generalizing that set of axioms on an arbitrary, on a curved space. And then after that, I discretize them and I can put them as a constraints. But I personally don't particularly like that. The reason is that it's just too artificial. The beautiful thing about causal sets is that they look very natural. And by making something as artificial as this as a restriction of causal sets is not something I personally would enjoy doing. The other idea that I have is to use fermionic fields. I recently published a paper where I have interpreted the fermionic field as a particular reference frame, namely the one in which fermionic field is a linear combination of particle spin-up with antiparticle spin-up, together with some extra structure. And if I view the fermionic field as a reference frame, then this would mean that fermionic field will naturally form coordinate system around it. So when I will introduce fermionic fields on a manifold, I will have some kind of coordinate system created by those fermionic fields, and those fermionic fields will somehow force the causal set to be manifold-like by making sure that if they are not, then the propagator will be zero. But as far as putting fermionic field on a manifold, on a causal set, that is a work in progress. So far, the paper that I've published is just a fermionic field on a manifold, not on a causal set. And also, I've only done the classical part of it. I'm still thinking about the way of putting the Grassmann variables into that picture. And now, again, there are pros and cons here. The con here is that the whole idea of causal set is that I should not put any kind of manifold, any kind of coordinate system by hand. Things should arise naturally. And here I'm doing just that, which is precisely what I'm trying to avoid. But at the same time, I have an excuse of doing it, because I'm not just putting a coordinate system just to put a coordinate system, but rather I'm accomplishing two goals at the same time. One goal is the definition of the fermion, and the other goal is the causal set. And also, I like that approach because if I just put coordinate system by hand, then that looks like something without physical meaning. But here, fermions are the physical particles that form coordinate system around themselves. But that's a hypothetical. So those are some of my thoughts that have to do with the future work. And then obviously I also have to do the numerical simulations to see that high fluctuations field cancels each other the way I want them to. And that is also something I have to do. Anyway, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk.
Question about this axiomatization thing you had at the end. Do you mean to say that you've got? I didn't quite understand what we've got. So, do you have a list of criteria whereby you can say if the causal set satisfies these criteria, then it's manifold block. Or it looks like a manifold. Have you got some kind of definition of that? Or is it not that like?
Well, basically, in the book by Rob, he proposed an axiom for flat Minkowski space. And he have proven that if a Minkowski space satisfies those axioms, if any space satisfies those axioms, then it is in fact a flat Minkowski space. But clearly he done it only for continuous case. What I've done is that I took his statements and rewritten them in the corresponding statements with some modifications due to curvature. And after I made those modifications, I put some additional modifications due to the discreteness. And that part is very subjective. For example, I didn't I yet proven rigorously that if those modified version of the axioms would be true, then that set would be a manifold. I know that they are true for a manifold, but I have not proven yet that if they are true, then this would be a manifold. However, the excuse that I have is that the criteria for manifold-like causal set is very subjective. Because even if I did prove that it is a manifold, I would still be asked, well, how do I know that that once I discretize it, it would be a manifold? And then I would have no answer, because manifold is not discrete by definition. So since the criteria of being manifold-like is subjective from the start, I simply say that subjectively, if something meets those criteria, it would feel like a manifold. And precisely because that's subjective, that's precisely why I said in the beginning of the talk that I really don't like the idea of first defining a manifold by causal sets and then working on that particular thing. Because I might not agree with my own way of subjectively defining manifold by causal set. So for that reason, I personally would like to work with a lot of different ways of defining a manifold by causal set and then somehow making a universal definition of quantum field theory that would apply to all of them. So that I would not be so dependent on the correctness of my particular criteria for manifold by.
Just a follow-up comment on that. If in fact you have some set of axioms for a manifold, even in the continuum case, in terms of the causal structure, that would be very interesting because people have been interested in characterizing space-times by their causal structure. For a long time, since this work of Rob, we've known how to do it axiomatically, that is very concretely for Minkowski space. But to my knowledge, no one has any kind of explicit characterization of a curved manifold, Lorentzian manifold, in terms of its causal structure. So if you had a modified set of axioms that might provide that, then in itself I think would be very interesting.
Yeah, I do have that modified set of axioms, but I didn't do half of the work.
You didn't prove that they have to be
yeah.
a manifold, but if they even have a chance, or if they even capture part of being a manifold.
Yeah, that is like one of the things that I want to do. Like, well, one of my future projects is to see whether or not they will actually imply the manifold. If the answer is yes, then that's good. If the answer is no, then I will have to somehow add some axioms to them and take away. And that is something that I would like to do for the future. Right now, I don't yet know that the correctness would imply the manifold. Although I do know the other way around. I know that if I'm on a manifold, they will be correct. That part I know. Yeah, and I agree that is very interesting. So personally, my personal philosophy is that I have a lot of ideas that are very interesting, but at the same time, I would like to pursue more than one idea because I have pros and cons for each one. So if I pursue more than one idea, then I have a choice of what I think is interesting. So part of me agrees that the axiomatization of causal sets is interesting and I'm planning to work on that. But the other part of me thinks that, well, maybe using fermions to create a manifold-like structure is more interesting. So the other part would do that. And then I will compare my results.
So are there more questions or comments? So I had one thing I just wanted to add. You threw out right at the end, you threw out several interesting and some provocative suggestions. So were you suggesting to do a more generalized dynamics in which in the path integral you integrate over the dynamics themselves? making dynamics dynamical, so to speak. In other words, making the Lagrangian dynamical. Was that your proposal, that there's some set of Lagrangians, or all possible Lagrangians, or some standard Lagrangian with some parameters, and you integrate over the parameters as well and regard them as dynamical? And then the hope was that the correct Lagrangian would pick itself out. But did I understand? Or do you have a more concrete, more explicit version of that?
Okay, so let me put it that way. So basically, let me put it that way. So basically, I have a lot of Lagrangians, L1, comma, L2, comma, etc., comma, Ln. And then I have some kind of fields, F1, F2, etc., Fn. So in general, in the standard case, what people are integrating is that they sum that basically they sum and here let's put Fn. So basically the standard case is that they sum over n and n, and that S is equal to sum over sum over just n, and then they put Lk of F1 comma etc comma Fn. That's the standard way of doing it. But what I'm seeing, and in this case, it's going to be S of F1 comma etc comma Fn. But I'm saying that I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to modify it. I'm going to say that it is S of F1 comma etc comma Fn. And then apart from that, I'm going to also put L A1, LA2, etc., LAK. So I'm selecting some subsets of those Lagrangians. And then based on the selection of those subsets, that would be basically equal to sum over AK of LAK of F1, etc., Fn. So I'm not summing all possible Lagrangians, but I'm only summing the selected ones. And since I have different options of selecting different kinds of Lagrangians, depending on what Lagrangians I'm going to select, I'm going to get different answers for S. In the same way as dependent on what behavior of the fields I will select, I will also have different value of S. So I have two different variables of S. One variable is the behavior of each of those fields, F1, etc. And the other variable is the selection of AK, which is which Lagrangians I'm going to look at. And since those are two different variables of S, I can make S extremely small by two different ways. One way of making S small is by making Fs act in some crazy unlikely way. And the other way of making S small is by picking Lagrangians from which all the propagators could be small. And that would force me to do two different things. First of all, I would have to pick the right Lagrangians, and secondly, I would have to pick the right behavior of the fields in order to assure that the probability is not small.
I guess it's getting a bit late, so if there are no other urgent questions, maybe we could just thank Raman again.